You're listening to a 4x4 Radio Network podcast.
Hello, Bill Burke here, and we're having a fun interview at the SCAR event in Texas. Yeah.
The Center Steer Podcast, a Land Rover podcast by Land Rover owners. Welcome to the Center Steer Podcast, the only Land Rover podcast on the planet. This is show number 51 for June 2017. There is a Route 51 in Pennsylvania. That's immediately what I thought of when I heard of 51. This is a podcast by, for, and about Land Rover owners. Visit our website, centersteer.com, to listen to previous shows and for show notes, which have links to stories discussed in today's show. We're also part of the 4x4 Radio Network, and I invite you to check out the other 4x4 related shows at 4x4radionetwork.com. They had a correspondent at the Jeep Jamboree in Butler, Pennsylvania this past month. So if you want to see more about Jeeps and the ancestral heritage of Land Rover, check that out. Thanks for your comments, follows, and likes on Facebook, Twitter, and email. And now, Instagram. We're on the Instagrams. And a special thanks to our Patreon subscribers. Visit patreon.com/centersteer for all the details on how to support the show and possibly make a monthly contribution. I'm your host, John Costage, here in wonderful western Pennsylvania. The weather has is very nice. It's been spectacular for the last 3 or 4 days. We are recording at the end of June, right before Independence Weekend here in the United States. And joining me via Skype from also in western Pennsylvania, hasn't been on the show in a couple months, but you're back, Harold.
I am back. In some form or another.
You're Skyping in, and so hello to Harold. Is there anything you wish to add?
I'm not quite dead yet.
And joining us from the Green Mountain State.
Hey, it's Morgan.
And Morgan is owner and purveyor of SeriesParts.com for all your series parts needs.
That I am.
Our guest this month is Bill Burke of Bill Burke's Four Wheeling America fame. This is the last of the interviews that were conducted on site at the SCAR event. This interview with Bill was basically about Bill, not having to do much with off-roading or recovery, but about Bill, where Bill came from, how he got to be in the position that he's in, and talking about his business, which he teaches people to go off-road and do it safely. Look forward to bringing that interview to you later in the show. I want to thank our listener, Derek, who congratulated us on our 50th show. He said, that's fantastic, and keep up the good work. So thank you, Derek, for sending an email.
And reciprocal congratulations are in order. I believe it was this past weekend, but the St. Louis European Car Show, Derek took home best in class.
Woohoo! He has a Series 3?
2A.
2A. Nice. Well, congratulations.
Very nice.
Yeah. And a new friend of the show, Martin Port in the UK, who of Trans Africa fame. He is selling T-shirts that are based off of Trans Africa, the Trans Africa truck. They're 20 pounds, and that includes postage and handling, although they call it P&P. Was that postage and parcel or something? If you're interested, check him out. Check out his Facebook page or check out his Twitter account. I'll try to have a link in the show notes, too. He sold out the first batch, and I got one of those myself. I'm waiting for it to show up, and he's going to do a second run here of shirts. So yeah, go out and pick up a shirt. They're it'll help out Martin in keeping that truck on the road, which is
I believe P&P, by the way, is packing and postage. It's their equivalent of shipping and handling.
P&P instead of S&H.
Correct.
There we go. And I'm also excited to have Harold on the show because I can now reveal more details about my Continental Overland trip. Harold has been feverishly working on my truck to get it ready for my departure in mid-August. I'm going to head northeast and then go in a counterclockwise motion manner, distance, direction around the continent. But that's the current plan, and I'm going to be podcasting from the road. Not exactly sure how, when, or why, but we'll at least have monthly shows. I might even do some special one-off postings while I'm out on the road in the Defender 110. And Harold, anything you want to add besides you're still alive?
No.
So tomorrow
I can either sit here all night and whine about how much of a pain in the butt it's been, or I can just say, no, it's going to be nice when it's done.
It will
be appealing. You will like it.
I think I do. I would completely agree. This, from what I've seen so far, it looks good.
Certain design head, it will be appealing. You will like it.
I will. Indeed. Indeed. And I've posted some pictures. People have seen those, and I'll hopefully get some more up here in the next week or two. And then we'll have a nice reveal whenever the truck is complete. Tomorrow I'm going to the painters to pick up the doors and deliver those to Harold. By the time you hear the podcast, that should already have taken place. And the powder coating is done for the roof rack and the tire carrier, so I'll take that out to Harold tomorrow also. Things are going well in the truck, and I've formally given notice today to my employer that I'm quitting my job.
Congratulations.
I know I'm kind of mixed, to be quite candid, mixed about it, but there you go. So why don't we now move ahead with the show, and we will get into the news. And as we do, starting with sales, especially here in the U.S., things were very well for JLR in May. Sales were up for Jaguar, up 44%. They sold 3,113 units, which was about a grand more than they sold in May of 16. Land Rover was up a little bit. They were up, I think, 14% from May of 16, selling 4,993 units. So overall, JLR is up 22% in the U.S. for May sales. And
do we know which models are responsible for that increase?
For JLR, I believe it was the XE and the F-Pace.
Yeah, yeah.
The F-Pace hit 1,400 units in May.
Yeah. Of course, that's the deal for Jag.
Of course.
Yeah.
You'd appreciate this, Harold. The F-Type had its second best May month with 409 units sold.
Yeah, the Jag that belongs at Jaguar, a proper Jaguar.
I will say, as listeners may know, and I know you guys know, I have a Jetta Sport Wagon. It's TDI, and so it's subject to the lying, cheating scandal.
Legal action.
Yes, and when I saw the XE come out, I have to admit, I toyed with the idea. I did some looking at the XE because it's all-wheel drive and diesel here in the U.S., and I kind of toyed with that, looked at it for a bit, but I still like. I put new tires all on the Jetta, and it was fun to drive again. It got a renewed spark of drivingness.
I would suggest you get the Project 8 version of the XE, but you'll be buying tires even more often if you do that.
That's true. Yeah, I retweeted that on our Twitter page, but Harold, tell folks what that Project 8 is about. That was. That thing had a nice sound to it. Roadshow is the website, and they had the sound of that thing. It was amazing.
Yeah, I read about it on Auto Week, I think. But it's another one of the special vehicle things. They're doing these projects. The previous numeral project was Project 7, which was an F-Type. That they just beefed that thing up and made it really, really cool. Because, the ordinary F-Type is just not enough. But the Project 8, they did that with an XE, and they put, it's the cool thing is it's a lot like the glory days of the muscle car in this country back in the 60s when you took the smallest, lightest body you had and jammed the biggest, most powerful engine you had under the hood. And that's precisely what they've done. They've put, 564 horsepower, 575, something like that, in this compact sedan, which, by today's standards, that's not an obscene amount of power, but it's plenty. It makes the car really nice.
Well, it's not a big car
either. Limited edition. It's got a lot of other performance things, handling things and that sort of thing. And I think they're only making 200, I think, but... and of course, the really cool version you can't get here in the States, and what it is, they do a rear seat delete, and in place of that, they put in a full roll cage to stiffen the chassis up. But you can't get that here because we can't be allowed to have the cool stuff.
Naturally.
But anybody that wants to buy themselves a Project 8 and wants the cool version, buy the lame American version, bring it to me, I will hook you up, we'll make it happen.
Indeed. And that's not a big car either. Isn't that like the size of a BMW 3 Series, I think?
Yeah, it's their compact sedan. It's not big.
Yeah, so 500 horsepower in that.
Yeah, what's the power to weight ratio end up being with that? It's got to be pretty good.
Yeah, good, but I don't remember the numbers, to be honest.
And isn't?
But I do know it's out of my pay grade. It's like 150,000 oh, yeah. pounds or something like that.
Oh, yeah, the cost alone, yeah. Was it you, Harold, that told me about Dodge Vipers, where if you buy a Dodge Viper, you have to sign a special waiver that you know that this can kill you?
No, it's not the Viper. It's actually the Dodge a couple of years ago threw down the gauntlet with the Hellcat Challenger, which was, I think, 707 horsepower, something like that. It's the most power ever put in a production car in this country. Well, now that they've done that, they've got to top themselves. So now they came out with the Demon, which is north of 800 horsepower.
Wow.
Man.
Yeah. Well, and the thing is,
Hellcat was also the highest for the lowest price, which was ridiculous.
Right, and the Demon is actually a real good value too. I mean, it's not cheap, but I mean, for 800 horsepower, it's a hell of a deal. But the thing is that they've recognized that this actually is such an amount of power that there's a response. You know, with great power comes great responsibility, as they say, and so they will not let you buy that unless you acknowledge in writing, in the presence of a notary, that you understand this thing has too much power, and if you're going to do something stupid, someone will die. That way it's not their fault if it happens. They don't want to get sued. And that goes back to like in the 80s and 90s when the internet billionaires, you know, they hit their money and they'd go out and buy a Ferrari or a Porsche or whatever. And 2 hours later, they've wrecked it and killed themselves. And the heirs sue the company for failure to warn, which, mind you, if it's got prancing horses on the side and it says Ferrari on it, you know it's got lots of power. And if you
that's
do something
warning.
Stupid, someone will die. But, you know, they haven't warned you properly. So now Chrysler is cutting that process off at the knees by making you sign this sworn affidavit that you understand that it's your ass if someone dies.
Yeah, you'd think Jag might take that up, especially with the Project 8, and bring that over here.
Personally, I think it's a marketing thing. I think that they do that so that people can say, ooh, I got this car that's got so much power. I actually had to sign off in front of a notary.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, it's a bragging rights thing.
Yeah, indeed.
But, I mean, it's cool that they actually make that much power available for those who have to have it.
So we'll get back to Land Rover news. You asked Harold what specific models for the Land Rover were affecting sales, and the Discovery Sport.
Yeah. That's where we were.
Yeah, exactly. And the Disco Sport had its best ever May sales month with 904 units.
Right on.
Am I not mistaken? Isn't that the first full month of sales?
Something like that.
No, or maybe the second.
Not a bad number to start with, though.
That's true. Good point. Yeah, I saw one today when I went to lunch. I hadn't seen before. Nice color, too. It was an Alphaston Red Disco Sport. And also the Range Rover Sport had its best ever May sales month, and they sold 1,800 units. So good deal there.
Twice as many as the Disco Sport.
Oh, yeah, good point. Yeah, you're right. And three times the money, or twice the money. Moving on to business news, Jag Land Rover is going to create 5,000 new jobs in the UK. This is specifically around... They want 500 engineers and technical staff. Specifically, they're looking for electronic and software engineers. They are moving heavily into the autonomous vehicle space and also want to build electric vehicles.
Yeah, I was going to say that they want some engineers not only for the autonomy but also for the electric vehicle stuff.
Yeah, so if you're, I think if you're in the UK or want to go to the UK, there might be an opportunity for you. Along those lines, JLR also put a $25 million. Invested $25 million in Lyft, which is similar to Uber. They did this through their JLR's In Motion business. I think it's a separate business, or maybe it's a wholly owned subsidiary, maybe.
I think that's part of that initiative for the tech incubator that they set up last year.
Okay, that would make sense. Yeah, because they want to. The InMotion is going to develop and test services, including autonomous drive vehicles with Lyft. So it would make a lot of sense. So
you mentioned Lyft is similar to Uber, but now it's much cooler.
Yeah, although the it's perception that it's much cooler. Yeah. Oh, well, it's much cooler because Land Rover invested. Because Land Rover invested in it.
Correct.
And also, they're going to be providing vehicles. They didn't say.
Does that mean you can use an app on your phone to order a trail ride?
Hey, there's an idea. Yes, you could. Maybe down the road, you might be able to. That's a good idea, Harold. I'm sure there are people jumping all over that now. Further in company news, the JLR plant in Slovakia is going to be investigated for the amount of money that they were granted, or what we would call in the U.S. a subsidy, to build that plant. So apparently the European Commission is probing the £108,000 grant from the Slovakian government. So I guess that puts that plant – there's no indication as to whether they're going to continue to build the plant or stop building the plant. But it was interesting to note from the article that I read that JLR came out and said that if they didn't get that grant for Slovakia, they would have built the plant in Mexico.
So then the question is, if for some reason this thing falls through and they don't build the plant in Slovakia, will they resume their plans for Mexico?
Yeah, who knows? It's a good question.
Because that'd be cool.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
That would be a little better for us, too.
Although this has not been the best year to, start building anything in Mexico.
Or maybe it is the best year. Maybe the costs there have dropped. You never know.
That's true. Well, and we'll have to see what happens with the wall. That might restrict imports.
Well, but see, now that creates an interesting new commercial opportunity. Remember the old commercial where it winched itself up the dam?
Winched itself up the solar-powered wall.
That's
correct.
True.
Mm-hmm. JLR in India plans to expand their retail outlets next year. They currently have 25 retail outlets in 23 of the major cities in India, and they're going to add two or three more next year. I'm kind of surprised they didn't have that many. It doesn't seem like a lot. India's a big country, and I'm surprised they only have 23 or 25 outlets?
Right, but look at the economy in India. They're kind of new to luxury vehicles.
Yeah, good point. And I guess the Jag XE is now available in a 2-liter diesel now in India, too. So good on them.
Right on.
Along dealership news, back in the U.S., this is an editorial to Automotive News entitled Land Rover Store Refresh Goes Too Far. And this individual is talking about how Land Rover's forcing the dealers in the U.S. to spend money on refreshing the dealership, and see this. So the dealers are now being. I'm reading here from the article. Dealers are now being required to do what is being dubbed a refresh. This will replace a very unique Lodge look in favor of the now popular glass and steel look. Say goodbye to their mark of distinction. Well, there you go. The number of people who comment on the different feel of the Land Rover stores compared to other dealerships is remarkable. Daily occurrence in our store. Point of this is, Land Rover's making a change here in the U.S. in the dealers and how they look. I'm sure this costs them a lot of money, and I'm sure Land Rover doesn't help with that cost.
Yeah, no. Welcome to retail.
Yeah, and it's, that's just across the automotive industry. The dealer association is constantly griping about some brand that's making them do that, and it's nothing new. And General Motors was huge for that, like 8-10 years ago, like when the big downturn happened, and they started consolidating and getting rid of dealers and canceling franchises. And the way you kept your franchise was to pretty up your store at your own expense.
And let's face it, the whole, metal and glass, that's the new luxury, and that's what Land Rover is trying to sell. So it makes sense.
I'm sure Jerry would approve, and probably Jerry had a hand in that.
And the other way to look at it, too, is that now that, it's less about Land Rover centers being a standalone destination, because now it's Jaguar Land Rover. They're combining the dealerships, and it's hard to sell Jags at the Lodge.
But they have SUVs now.
You can't take the Jag on the off-road course?
Harold, they have SUVs now. Come on.
They should just divide it and have half Lodge, half metal and glass luxury.
Urban, town and gown.
Off-road course on the other.
Well, there you go, Rallycross. You've got the one section that's paved and the other section that's not.
Now that's a great idea.
JLR has also teamed up with a company called Listener, LSNR, to personalize cars using sound. And the headline is not what it is. It's using sound as the carrier, similar to Bluetooth or radio waves, to access the vehicle or to change the personalize the vehicle in the sense of where's the seat, what radio stations do you have access to in the vehicle. Sounds kind of interesting. I'm not sure what the immediate application.
So it's actually like a communication protocol for your devices to speak using sound waves.
Yeah, that's my read. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm not familiar with this particular company or protocol, but there's several out there that have been used in the past that use an inaudible audio frequency and a unique signal to identify devices. And one of the benefits is that unlike technologies like Bluetooth and Wi-Fi, where really you just have to be within a certain distance, it doesn't matter whether you're inside or outside of the vehicle. The audio signals, really, you have to be within the vehicle. So if you're outside the vehicle, those, high frequency signals are not really going to pass through glass. Well, it's less vulnerable to hacking.
So it's a secure protocol.
I wouldn't go so far.
More secure.
My read on that is that I think there's listening on the outside of the vehicle too, because there's some discussion in this article about. You would have maybe an app on your phone, and as you approach the vehicle could unlock and personalize itself to you because it knows that it's John or Harold, and it would know to change the seat distance, as an example. So I think there's listening on the outside. And further, I just read this line while you guys were talking. It says, a car equipped with this technology could theoretically communicate with a number of other devices equipped with the same tech. That could possibly include other cars. Because vehicle-to-vehicle communication is like one of the big things that's coming for the super highways that they're projecting for the future. So I wonder if this might also be a way for vehicles to communicate with each other as they're going down the highway. Hey, I'm doing 80 miles an hour and I'm 10 feet behind you. And if you start to brake, then I can start to brake too.
We already have that technology for vehicles to communicate with each other using audio waves. It's called a horn.
Such a good point. And I was sitting here imagining like R2-D2 sounds coming from the Land Rovers.
So what
I'm curious to know is there an interference problem with engine noise and stuff?
Well, I think hence the reason why they're probably working with this company to develop those things.
I can't imagine retrofitting this to a series truck, for instance.
Yeah.
Although I think down the road, eventually, I've said this before, I think you will see, and it may be 30 years out or maybe 15 years out, but I think all cars will probably be required to have some sort of, planes have this IFF device, identify friend or foe, something somewhere where it's like a transponder. You'll probably have to have it on the vehicle to say, hey, I'm an old Land Rover. I can only go 55 miles an hour if I'm lucky, and that way when you're out on a highway or on the road, other cars will go, okay, there's something there we need to worry about. It's as a minimum, more so than the modern cars will communicate with each other saying, I'm going 80 miles an hour. I'm now braking, so you should brake too. So we brake in the chain, that train concept.
And if you could do that as a retrofit to allow a legacy vehicle, if you will, to operate on the new roadways, that wouldn't be a bad thing.
Just
a little device that basically says, I'm a Land Rover. I don't go fast.
Don't go fast. Yes, exactly. Which would make it safer for everybody, too, because you got cars doing 120 miles an hour down the motorway, down the interstate, and you're on a bend in an old Series 3. Yeah, I wouldn't mind having cars behind me know that I'm up ahead. All right. Why don't we move ahead to another American story. No export policy at JLR draws fire. So a gentleman by the name of Brian Barr bought a 2015 Range Rover in Carlsbad, California, and he said he would have resold the vehicle for export within 1 year had JLR not made him sign an agreement that subjects him to hefty penalties. And JLR is not the only one that does this, apparently. Porsche and someone else who I need to find in the article have also stopped people from reselling cars outside of the U.S., I guess, and also other countries. Because the manufacturer's reasoning is demand is high in another country. This vehicle was designed for the U.S. or is available in the U.S. And we don't want you just to make a buck off of it by turning around and shipping it out of the country. So there's a class action lawsuit against Land Rover now.
It also implies that the North American version of these vehicles for some reason is actually more desirable in other places, which is interesting because normally we don't get the cool stuff, but apparently for certain some things we do.
Well, I think it sounds like China and Russia are the other countries that these vehicles typically get reshipped to. So,
okay, yeah, supply and demand there. Yeah. They just can't get their hands on enough of them.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Because Barr says he could have made up to $40,000 for shipping a vehicle to China for resale, and he would have continued to lease or purchase and resell more cars if he had not been forced to sign the agreement.
Well, one key word there is lease. That you part of it is probably also to make sure that people aren't leasing and buying and then maybe falling through on the lease and the vehicle is outside of the country already.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, that gets tricky legally. But it sounds like the guys like got a flipping business going, and that's kind of not cool anyway.
Well, there's that too. Yeah,
right.
All right.
I could see it in terms of, you know, we talk about the North American version being cool. You know, if you really want, if you have enough money to afford the petrol, and you want a big V8, those are hard to get in Europe. So if you wanted that kind of stuff, it would make sense that you're buying it here.
Land Rover and Jaguar win design awards. The Land Rover has won the Best Brand Design Language Award at the 2017 Car Design Awards for its family of vehicles, including the Velar, and this was at the Turin Motor Show. Jaguar I-Pace Concept Electric Performance SUV brought more success, winning the Concept Car Category Award. So there you go. Good. I guess there's Jerry McGovern, who's Land Rover's Chief Design Officer, accepted the inaugural Best Brand Design Award, and he said...
Of course he did.
He said, "It's great to be recognized for the hard work and creative endeavor of the whole Land Rover team. This is a true team effort and one that will continue the transformation of our business." Continuing with awards, in the UK, Auto Express has designated the new Land Rover Discovery, the Disco 5, as the car of the year for 2017.
So that's like the UK version of our Motor Trend North American Car of the Year or something like that.
That was my take. Yes, so good for them.
Okay. There you go. That's cool.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely. Land Rover reveals a Level 4 self-driving Range Rover Sport. This is pretty cool, actually. The vehicle is capable of Level 4 autonomous driving, which means it can theoretically handle itself in just about every conceivable driving scenario within a selected environment, though it will still have a human behind the wheel to observe and stand guard to seize control if the computers go awry. The self-driving Range Rover Sport is reportedly able to read and reach to traffic lights and negotiate conventional intersections and roundabouts alike, along with presumably every other capability it would need to make its way around town. What is reach?
I'm wondering if maybe that's just a British way of saying that it can communicate with them, speak to them.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I thought it was a typo. Read and reach.
Well, might be, but it seems to me if that's intentional, that might be what they're trying to say.
Yeah, okay. All right. And I guess this Range Rover, they think will get on to actual highways and the streets of the UK by the end of the year.
That's pretty cool. And it's kind of an interesting distinction, the Level 4 self-driving thing, because, you know, originally when the Range Rover first came out, it was, unofficially, a Level 4 self-braking vehicle. Capable of braking itself with or without human interaction.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, I think, right. Well... And now they're moving up to that new level. It's full autonomy then, when it can steer and brake and go on its own.
Right. And when I say brake, self-braking, I don't mean B-R-A-K. I mean B-R-E-A-K.
Oh, it was a joke. Okay.
Well, not a good one, apparently.
Sorry. I didn't realize. My apologies for the oversight.
Well, yeah, I failed to consider the homonym.
So Land Rover is working on this self-driving Level 4 Range Rover, which I'm sure will get pushed out to all the other models. Well, that actually, if you think about it, it goes along with all the other technology they've packed into these trucks lately. They've got the invisible bonnet, the cameras all around the exterior so you can see what's going on. Yeah, they don't.
Right.
And you know, so these all things are kind of crystallizing and coming together. Self-braking, of course, is another part of that. They There's no mention.
And of course, it's fitting that the new tech, of course, rolls out on the Range Rover first, and then filters down to the lesser families.
Oh, of course, yeah, that's what everybody Ford did that with, you know, start with Lincoln, and General Motors did that with.
And it's what
Cadillac.
It should be.
You got
if
more
it's
money.
It's going to be the premium brand, then it needs to have the coolest stuff first.
No word on off-road autonomous driving. Although, let's face it, what's the point? I don't get that.
Right.
Next in the Land Rover news, well, this is really less Land Rover than it is industry-wide, but Land Rover managing JLR, managing director Jeremy Hicks, this time, said to, you know, had a discussion about stop demonizing diesel. So we've heard this before from Spaeth, but now another Land Rover, well, I guess JLR, executive is talking about how diesels are not as bad as people think they are. He makes the point that this is, we're in a newer generation of diesel fuel, and that it is much more environmentally friendly, and it is better than it has been in the past for the environment, and is more efficient than it has been in the past. I think efficient. I think I saw that here.
It is.
And so try not to, you know, to demonize it and continue to use it. It's part of the mix of things that Land Rover and Jag Land Rover is looking at as a fuel.
I mean, ultimately, you know, we're going to be done with fossil fuels at some point. But in the meantime, we still have to use them. And diesel is actually a better way to use fossil fuel than gasoline.
Specifically, why is it?
There's more BTUs in a gallon of diesel, and that's why you get better fuel economy, for one. And the other is the way that the diesel is designed to work inherently. You know, gasoline engines always have to run at a particular air-fuel ratio. It's called stoichiometric air-fuel ratio. It's about 15 to 1. Technically, it's about 14.7, something like that. But diesels run at a variety of mixtures depending on need. And when you need the power, it can run pretty rich to get more power. But when you don't need it, and like when it's idling and stuff, it's really like 21, 22 to 1. Very, very little fuel for the amount of air that's passing through. It can run very, very lean when it's idling, which makes it more efficient in that way. And the other thing is, when you talk about, you know, in that sense, we're using less fuel. That's good for the environment. But the other thing is that in terms of carbon footprint, which is the big thing everybody's talking about now, the carbon emissions from a diesel are much better than gasoline. It puts out less CO2 per horsepower, if you will. I mean, there's a lot of different ways to measure it. It puts out a lot less CO2 emissions than a gasoline engine. Where diesel gets into trouble is the oxides of nitrogen. And so, I mean, it's kind of a mixed bag there. And it gets very complicated. It gets very expensive to try and control that. And that's actually where Volkswagen got into their legal problem, was they were spewing lots and lots of NOx, which if you don't do what you need to do with a diesel, it's going to put out a lot of NOx, because that's related to exhaust gas temperature, which can be hot on a diesel when you've cranked up the output. But at the same time that you're spewing lots of NOx, you have a very clean carbon footprint at the same time. So it's kind of a double-edged thing. But done properly and properly maintained, properly controlled with all of the bells and whistles, diesel is better for the environment than gasoline.
Appreciate that explanation. Continuing on with Hicks's comment, I thought this was the interesting one relevant to us specifically, is he says, quote, "We're on a journey to new zero emission future, and the latest high-tech diesels in our cars are just an important step on that journey. By 2020, just 3 years away, half of all cars we at Jag Land Rover offer will have the option of electrification."
Okay. And when they say electrification, does that mean hybrid, or does that mean an electric vehicle?
That's a good question. That is unclear. I'm guessing it's going to be a hybrid, but the more we hear about JLR, they're looking at full electrification. At least that's the things I've seen. So, but maybe it could be a hybrid too.
Well, yeah, long term, of course, that is where it's all going to end up being. But in the meantime, hybrid, if done properly, can be pretty cool.
Yeah, I think what Spaeth said last month was that electrification just meant some electricity in the power, in the drive system.
Okay.
So that could be hybrid. And yeah,
that 50%. Sounds like the definition of hybrid.
Yeah.
And now specific Jag news, although this goes along with just what we talked about, 2018, the Jaguar I-Pace is going to be an all-electric vehicle, and they are in development. It's going to be the first all-electric model set to arrive in 2018, which is what actually that means they should be pulling it out here in the next couple months. These damn auto run ads. Jeez, stop it. So they have some fresh spy shots of that, of this I-Pace crossover. So it's coming. And Jag is investing heavily. Jaguar in particular, they say, is investing heavily in electric technology, you know, which go along with what we've discussed though. Just continue to look at diesels and also smaller displacement four-cylinder engines for the fleet.
And the interesting thing is I'm less annoyed by that in their fleet than the F-Pace.
You'll like this part too, Harold. Jaguar hasn't confirmed U.S. specs. But based on the concept car, the I-Pace, generates 400 horsepower and 516 pound-feet of torque to all four wheels from a 90 kilowatt-hour lithium-ion battery pack. The crossover can hit 60 miles per hour in 4 seconds and has an expected range of 220 miles.
Well, you know, the cool thing about those torque specs when you're talking about an electric vehicle is those 560 pound-feet or 516, I forget what the number
516.
Was. 516 pound-feet of torque are available at zero RPM.
Yes, now.
And that's the key. That is the big difference between an electric vehicle and internal combustion. Internal combustion, you've got to have that engine running. You've got to spin it up, but you've got to hook it up to the wheels and get that power to the ground, and you lose a lot of RPM doing that. So then you're kind of like rolling out, and then you hit the peak torque. Meanwhile, the electric vehicle is gone. See ya.
Yes, all of it now. You want it? You have it now. Yes.
I mean, if you're going to have it, why not have it now?
And it's true through the entire power band, too.
Right. It's very, very linear.
No matter your...
It is the flattest torque curve available, if you want to talk the terminology.
And that's the interesting thing is people complain about, oh, we're going to go all electric, and I like my guy. Like, no, because really, when at the end of the day, you want the speed and you want the power. Electric is the way to go. It's just, boom, it's there. You know, it's
the only reason that electric vehicles suck is the storage of the energy, because you can't pack much storage into the vehicle and get any kind of useful range without a ton, literally a ton of batteries, and it makes the vehicle very heavy. But, you know, if you can find a more compact way to store the energy or produce it on board, which is my thing, the motor itself is very compact, and you need a smaller output of motor relative to the equivalent in the internal combustion because of what I said about all the torque being available at zero RPM. That makes the vehicle so much more drivable. So you can have a very lightweight, high-performance vehicle, and of course, the lighter it is, the quicker it is, if it weren't for having to carry 1,000 pounds of storage battery. Once they get that figured out, it's all about the batteries. Once they get the new frontier storage, mm-hmm. electric vehicles are it.
Done deal. Yeah, I agree. Absolutely. That's been the thing. That's why lithium-ion is far superior.
That's been
the
thing
for
40 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, and actually, the very first car was all electric, wasn't the first at least American, or was it the Mercedes or the Oldsmobile? One of them was all electric at the time.
There were electric vehicles at that time, but no, Oldsmobile was not electric. The first Benz was not electric. The first Mercedes was not electric. Of course, the Mercedes wasn't the first Daimler car either. But none of that stuff was electric. It was all internal combustion back then.
But
electric was available at the turn of the century, but yeah. It had the same problems it has now. No range, and they were really expensive.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
So they didn't catch on.
Jag Land Rover is the latest to patent an active aero system. This is pretty interesting technology. They published an application in the UK, and they're calling it Vehicle Aerodynamics Apparatus. I think I said that right. And it's different than existing active aero systems. Chevy recently patented an active aero system, but the American automaker is going after speed and handling for its sports car, while JLR seems to be more interested in fuel efficiency. And so in the patent application, JLR explains how the drag of the rear-facing surfaces of a car can account for upwards of 30% of the total drag. A traditional way of combating this is by boat tailing, a styling cue which sees the rear end of the vehicle taper inwards vertically and horizontally. And we've already seen that in JLR because that's the design lately has been that kind of tapering in the rear. But JLR explains aesthetics and packaging considerations limits applicability in automotive design, as not all designs fit with this tapered rear end look. Could that be Defender, maybe? The company hopes to change that with its Active Aero system, which essentially allows a vehicle's rear end to squeeze in a small amount to create a natural boat tail. Application also details air inlets opening. I read that wrong. The patent application also details air inlet openings formed in vertical fins that would direct air over an outer skin of a rear deck lid and onto a rear air deflection device. And there's a picture of it in the application, I think. So air would come in.
That's really interesting to me. I could nerd out on that for a while. Actually, when I was back in college, I used to compete in some fuel mileage competitions. And actually, my senior thesis in college was an aerodynamic body for a fuel mileage thing. And I kind of ended up by accident developing the body with passive aero changes, much like this. When you turned upwind, it would get skinnier and a little slipperier going upwind by accident, but it was cool. It worked.
Nice. Pictures here show air coming along the side of the Range Rover and then ducking into the rear C-pillar and coming back out again. And instead of, as I kind of read there, instead of it being mechanically tapered in, then I guess the air would flow inside the C-pillar and then back out again. So I guess that's what
That's being done by a number of manufacturers these days to try to eliminate having a spoiler on the back. They're doing it for downforce, but they're ducting the air. They're pulling it in the middle and redirecting it out the back in ways that enhance the high-speed stability.
Pretty interesting, although the article ends by saying that it might be quite a while before that makes it into production vehicles that we would use. I don't know. I'm not so sure. I think that's...
Maybe not.
Yeah, I think that might go sooner rather than later.
It becomes a packaging thing to a certain extent. You have to be able to do this without sacrificing interior volume.
And also you have to design it into the vehicle. So as I would think as they refresh a model, they can then consider how to include that in the vehicle itself. Yeah, it's not something
right.
You're just going to take an existing one and then add in some slits, I suppose, to let air in. Maybe you can.
No, it's not a styling thing, but I mean, it's not a retrofit thing, but it's something that has to go into new vehicles. But the styling, the design, the engineering, they all have to work together on this thing. Yeah. Historically, that doesn't work well.
And actually, Land Rover's already doing this with the new Disco 5. In a way, they have that snorkel idea built into the bonnet, with air coming in and circulating through the bonnet and the wings before getting into the air intake system as a means to get around water.
Right,
getting
that's,
in.
That snorkel without a snorkel thing that they're doing.
Yeah, pretty interesting. So it seems a similar concept to me. So maybe it already is here.
In a way it is, yeah.
All right, it's time again. Harold, you're going to do the theme tune for Jerry has talked about design again?
our Jerry bashing segment.
Well, you call it that. I prefer not to call it Jerry bashing, but I prefer to call it Jerry's talked about design, and we're going to comment on it.
What did Jerry say next?
Play the jingle.
I don't have a jingle yet. I'm still writing, but
all right.
Maybe next month.
New Land Rover Defender, not far away, design boss says. And this is a relatively short article, but he was Mr. McGovern, Jerry McGovern, who's Land Rover's design chief. It was at a conference. I forget where. It was in Spain. So he talked about the upcoming Defender design, and he says he's been forced to struggle with redefining the iconic Land Rover Defender for a new generation without losing the spirit and capabilities that made the rig so notable in the first place. So he was at this Automotive News European Congress event in Barcelona, and he said that the next generation Defender would stay true to its roots, but would also be more than a carbon copy of the old version. In order to build the brand, McGovern said Land Rover needs to, quote, create desirable and relevant vehicles to appeal to a wider group of customers, unquote. But don't think this means the new Landy will be some sort of wimpy soft rotor aimed at yuppie millennials. Quote, you'll be able to kick the hell out of them and they'll get up for more, unquote, McGovern said of the next generation Defender. Finally, he said the new Land Rover Defender is not far away, but that's all he would say.
I like that term, soft rotor. I like that.
That was not Jerry's term. That was not Jerry's term. I've heard soft rotor before. Yeah,
yeah, that's pretty cool. That's new to me. But
that's like all wheel drives is typically what I think. With that's, you know, like the all wheel drive stuff, Subarus and those kinds of things.
Well, careful when you lump, you know, all wheel drive, because of course the Range Rover was all wheel drive from 1970 on, and it was not soft by any means. I got to say, this is, you know, less offensive than many things he says. Of course, he didn't really say a lot that he hasn't already said. Yeah, he's got to make it appeal to a broader audience. He's tasked with the job of redesigning it without, you know, deviating too far from the original feel of it and that sort of thing. That's all stuff he said before. I like the fact that he's really hammering home the idea that you can beat the crap out of it and it won't break. I like that. I do like that. And I'm just pleased as punch that he didn't slip in that little thing about, you'll like it. It'll be appealing.
Come on, Harold. You'll like it. It'll be wonderful. You'll really enjoy it. It'll look great.
Yeah, I like being told how I'm going to feel about something.
I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what it does eventually look like. I am a little concerned about what Jerry considers kicking the crap out of a vehicle to be. But, you know, still, as long as he's taking that into consideration, I'm somewhat appeased.
Well, I'm sure it won't be anywhere near the magnitude of some of our friends who'd like to kick the crap out of things. But the point is, though, that if he is saying this about it, it sounds like it's going to be more durable than the other members of the lineup.
Absolutely.
And maybe that's all it needs to do at this point. I don't know. Certainly, it'll be better in that regard than the other stuff that's out there. Not that the other stuff's bad, but I'm just saying that if he's making the point about how it being able to take a beating, it sounds like he's making a distinction from everything else.
I'm glad you made that point. I mean, definitely, the newer Land Rovers have gotten better reliability-wise, and they seem to, from the things I've seen at least, have held up, although you don't see many, you know, D4s or Disco 4s or modern Range Rovers out on the trail, but they do seem to do pretty well and have held up anyways. And still,
you will see them out there once they get cheap.
Exactly.
Yeah,
right.
And that was going to say that there's a few out there right now, and it's really the price and the cost that's the factor there. You want to break something that doesn't cost a ton to replace.
Correct.
And the other distinction to make is that, you know, the newer stuff is more reliable and yeah, it may eventually find its way on the trail, but it will never look better when bashed like the series truck always has.
So true. So true.
But then you might affect the active air intake too. It could be.
Yeah. Right.
Well, as you know, we continue to monitor close to our hearts Defender News. One or two more stories here, and then we'll move on to the Bill Burke interview. Jaguar Land Rover has opened the Classic Works to preserve and restore historic cars. So they have opened a facility that is next door to the SVO facility for which is the Special Operations Center. The Special Vehicle Operations, which is in the Special Operations something. I don't know. Anyways, so the classic business sits alongside those guys. And this is a special place that will allow for old Land Rovers and Jaguars to be restored, rebuilt by Jaguar Land Rover technicians. This facility has 50 workshop bays, 100 square meters of showroom space, 480 vehicle storage spaces, and a staff of 90.
Now, the one thing I didn't quite get in this article is that, I mean, it sounds like when they have this showroom space, they're going to be restoring these vehicles on spec, like they're doing with the Series 1s right now. I'm curious to know is if you can order a restoration for hire, bring them your stuff, and have the factory redo it for you.
That was my impression. I believe that's the case.
I would think that's what they're going to do, but I didn't see it in the article specifically.
Well, podcast exclusive. We know someone who attended the opening of the Classic Works facility, and he could not join us on the show today, but we were hopefully going to interview him next week. That's Martin Port, who was on talking about the Trans Africa truck. So we'll certainly learn more when we get Martin on and talk about the Classic Works facility.
Yeah, it looks like a phenomenal place. I've seen the pictures. 50 bays is pretty hardcore.
Yeah. And yeah, the pictures, I like how everything looks very pristine and futuristic. Everything's clean. There's no grease.
Yeah. There's it's only that way once, mind you.
Well, maybe that's the reason for the showroom, Harold. There, you know, the showroom there is nice and clean, and then in the back is where all the grease and grime and dust is.
Where the important stuff happens.
Yes.
Still, I'm going to call this place Her Majesty's Bitchin' Shop.
And I think we have a show title.
It kind of sounds like heaven to me.
It occurs to me that it really cool way they could have done the grand opening at this facility, by the way, just to add to it, is that it would have been cool if Her Majesty had come and spun a spanner or two, since she used to do that back in the day, before Land Rover existed, mind you, but still, it would be cool. I mean, I would love to see the Queen pick up a wrench and go after it.
Yeah, and she's still tied to the brand. You know, she's driven a modern Defender. She has a Range Rover. She's driven it. All right, well, that's hopefully we'll have more in the future about the classic works from Martin himself. Again, hope to get him on the show very shortly just to talk about that. And
yes, please.
And then finally, we're going to talk about the Vermont Overland, and I'll turn it over to Morgan.
Thank you. The Vermont Overland Trophy, I haven't seen a whole lot of news about it in the last couple of years. They used to publish it quite heavily. It always sold out quickly. Now, that's the sort of Camel Trophy style overland rally event that happens in Vermont. They're doing it this year, the last I think weekend of July, and they finally announced how you actually get into that at this point, since they don't publish it quite as much, and since it is always booked. So essentially, there are now two ways that you can get in. One, you can buy an existing Vermont Overland Trophy member's seat. So if there's somebody who's attended in the past, they pay for their seat. If they want to sell out, that's fine. You can buy in their seats. You can reach out to Peter Vollers, who runs the events, and he can sort of get you in touch with people who are looking to sell their seats. And then the other way is, if you reach out to him, they are frequently, you know, interviewing for new competitors, specifically sponsor competitors. So if you want to be a sponsored competitor, you can apply to do that as well. So those are the two ways you can get in. And they do have a website showing the previous year's rankings and podium for the event, because it is an actual competition. And I believe that this year they're actually going to have a media team filming the event and producing a documentary afterwards. So it sounds like we'll have a little more, you know, insight into that event going forward, which is
very
nice.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
And then, of course, they still have the Vermont Overland Rally, which is a weekend it's traditional rally with vendor fair, food fair, and then you can go out to the trails in Vermont as well to drive the Class 4 roads and stuff like that. So that still happens.
Now, is that the event where, in order to get your score, you have to bring back receipts from local establishments where you ate lunch?
No, that's the Muddy Chef, isn't it?
Right, that's Muddy Chef.
Muddy Chef, you actually have to make food on site, but I thought that the Vermont Overland Rally was the place where your proof of making the stage on the route was a receipt from a place
I think you are right, Harold. I think you are right. I'm confusing the two. I think you're correct.
I think that's actually part of the Vermont Overland Trophy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, wait a minute. So there's the Vermont Overland Trophy. There's the Vermont Overland Rally, and there's Muddy Chef Challenge.
Well, Muddy Chef happens in Connecticut.
That's Connecticut.
But it's about the same time. They do that in, I think, mid-August, right?
Right.
And then
and Vermont Overland Rally is the last week of September. And into October.
And the Vermont Overland Trophy is the one that's going to take place, as you've been talking about, and that takes place in late July.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so the trophy is the actual, you know, competition challenge. It's a long-distance challenge along, some paved but mostly dirt, and then Class 4 roads and trails in Vermont. And then the rally is more of a traditional get together where you have a show site with camping and vendors and food vendors, and then you go out and hit the trails during the days.
And presumably it's more crowd friendly. I mean, it doesn't sell out a year in advance, and you don't have to get your name on a waiting list, etc.
It's a little more crowd friendly. It's still popular enough that when the tickets went on sale in January, the general admission tickets were sold out, I think, within a month.
Okay.
And all that remained were vendor tickets, both very popular. But I think that the reason that the Vermont Overland Trophy has been somewhat under the radar the last few years is because it sold out so quickly, was so popular. And it really is a grueling challenge. It's not like just going and doing some trails. You are going from point A to point B in short order through some horrendous conditions. They really only want the people who are dedicated to doing that and willing to risk their vehicles, hopefully not themselves, you know.
Right, but it's hardcore.
Yeah, it is very much hardcore.
All right, well, thanks very much for that update and how to get into the Vermont Overland Trophy. And we'll have a link in the show notes. There is a link, right, for this?
There is, yes.
Okay. When we come back to the 51st show of the Center Steer podcast, we will talk with Bill Burke of Bill Burke's Four Wheel Drive America. Welcome back to the Center Steer podcast. It's time for our guest of the month for show number 51. This is Bill Burke. This is the last of the interviews that were conducted at Texas Rover's event, SCAR, in Gilmer, Texas. Bill Burke has competed in the Camel Trophy once, and he applied once before that. So I consider him a two-time Camel Trophy participant. This makes him probably one of the most respected off-roaders in North America, having competed in the Camel Trophy, continuing to be in the off-road community. Since then, he has his own business, Bill Burke's Four Wheel Drive America. He's one of the individuals that I wanted on the show from the very first start of the show, put him down first on the list. So I was very, very happy to have him on the show. Talk less about off-roading and recovery. We talked more about where Bill Burke came from. Bill Burke is a permitted outfitter with a Bureau of Land Management. This allows him to take individuals out onto federal lands on the west end of the United States. And if you're interested in going out with Bill Burke on the trail, you want to check out his website, bb4wa.com.
And if you didn't already know who he was, you really haven't had a Land Rover more than about 10 minutes. He needs no introduction. He is the one, the only, the Bill Burke.
And we are now back at SCAR for the Texas Rover's annual SCAR event. Sitting across from Bill Burke of Bill Burke's Four Wheeling America, that's bb4wa.com, in his palatial trailer, although his trusty Land Rover is right outside, a Defender. Bill, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for having me.
And this is kind of challenging because I have a microphone and we've got to go back and forth. Bill, yeah, everyone knows you from Four Wheeling America, letting everybody know how to go off-road and do it safely and do it in a tread lightly fashion. I want to focus, though, on Bill Burke and where you come from. I know you bleed green, attended your beginner's course today. I can tell from that, you know, anybody talks to you for a few minutes, you know you bleed green. So, Bill, how'd you get into Land Rovers? How did that get all started?
Well, it started with, I'll blame it on my Scoutmaster. I was a Boy Scout in Florida, and one of my Scoutmasters had a Land Rover. I think it was a 66 Series 2A. And so we used to go out, you know, pull the scout trailer, the troop trailer with that, and then he would drag us around, and then that was with the early Jeeps and Broncos and things like that. So, but Fred, the Scoutmaster, was able to put dual tires, front and rear, on the truck, and now I know what he did. He swapped a Salisbury axle out that had duals already on it, and then for the old standard Land Rover axle, but back in that day, I didn't really understand that. So I was always impressed with how he could just kind of drive around the swamps and pull the Jeeps out and pull the Broncos out, you know, and whenever everybody else got stuck, it was always Fred that came and pulled us out. And so I thought, that's the truck I want to have when I grow up. That was in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. So raised right near the Everglades, the second truck in my neighborhood was an airboat or a swamp buggy. So, you know, learning to camp and appreciate the outdoors with those kind of people for hunters and fishing and all that, it just gave me a great appreciation for the outdoors. And then, the short is, I appreciated four-wheel drive vehicles. And, of course, the Rover was one of those things. Yeah, yeah.
You were in the Everglades, and then you had the 66 2A. Take us from there. Where did you end up? I know you were in the Army, and I believe you, as you said in the class earlier, you were a lumberjack. You did truck driving. Lead us to how you ended up where you are today.
Absolutely. Yeah. Boy Scout in the Florida swamps. And then you know, I went to college right out of high school for the first semester for forest and wildlife management, and then I didn't really like it. It didn't do well in academia, so I kind of dropped out, and I worked at a boat yard for a while, and then I got a draft notice, and draft notices tend to square people away pretty fast, so I went down, signed up, went in the Army. My father was always a learn a skill kind of a person, and he thought, you know, this is what you should do when you go in the Army, pick a skill. And so I figured, you know, equipment operator. And so I ended up, of course, they assigned me a task, and that was a recovery specialist. Little did I know that it was basically getting tanks unstuck from, you know, 1,400 feet of mud. So that's where I had my formal education of the military and all things green, and then obviously my formal rigging career for recovery. So that's why I do a pretty good job with teaching recovery and winching and, you know, the jacks and all that kind of stuff, because using a 2-inch wire cable on a 160,000-pound winch takes a little bit of formal learning. And it's easy to share that kind of rigging with folks. You know, from there, I got out of the Army. My second tour of duty was in Germany. I was with the 101st Airborne. I was a recovery specialist for a special unit. But, you know, people think I was an airborne guy or whatever, but I was a mechanic, basically. And my second tour was in Germany. And that was an armored unit. And so I learned about tank retrieval and heavy equipment and all that. And then traveled Europe extensively, because at the expense of the United States Army, which is great. And then, you know, fell in love with the mountains. And so when I came home, you know, I went to college for a while and went back to the Forest and Wildlife Management. And, you know, that did okay. But that's where I worked as a lumberjack at a cypress mill in Florida. Did that, ran one of the saws, you know, did those kinds of things. And then in school, being what it was, I ended driving a tractor trailer to pay the bills on the GI Bill. And so I ended up loving the tractor trailer, and I hauled hazardous materials, so liquid carbonics and hydrous ammonia and propane and stuff like that in tanks, and traveled southeast United States as a truck driver. You know, it was pretty good. So,
18-wheelers?
Yeah, 18-wheelers. Yeah, 10,000 pounds, 10,000-gallon tanks usually. Some were fertilizer. Some were, big propane and gas tanks, hydro fluids and things like that. Whatever you could throw in a tank, gunpowder, all sorts of stuff. So crazy stuff, and had hazardous material. So that was an interesting life at the time. I met my wife in college, and we ended up deciding to move to Colorado, because I fell in love with the mountains when I was in Germany, learned to ski and all that, and I just figured, let's go to Colorado, and I've had enough of Florida. So we get out there. We had, at the time, we had a 67 Series 2A. And 88-inch, and so I bought that. I had a Harley when I got out of the Army, so, of course, got to have a Harley. And then I married a woman with the kids, so we had to have a family vehicle. So we, what else, looked around, buy an old Land Rover. And so we drove that from Florida, you know, spent a few months traveling with the kids and, you know, spent a week here at a farm in Arkansas and another farm in Tennessee, and then ended up in Denver. And, you know, became a casual worker, moving furniture, driving trucks, working on trucks. I worked for International Harvester for a bunch of years as a mechanic and a fuel injection turbo specialist. So a lot of crazy stuff in the background there, you know. But and then the military unit that I was involved with did this thing called the Raid Gaulois. Gaulois is the French cigarette, like Camel cigarettes. And so it was a military thing, and we supported them as a mechanic, and they would air jump into a foreign country, and the one was in Madagascar that I remember. And that was the precursor to the Camel Trophy and the Eco Challenge things. And I kind of get involved in that adventure kind of racing things and followed the Camel Trophy. Tried out in 1986 for the U.S. team in Australia. And then I was an alternate at that time. But I saw how the British Land Rover folks taught four-wheeling. And with my skill sets and my outdoor education through Boy Scouts and leadership and all that kind of stuff in the military, I just realized that there's a way that I could probably make a living at doing this. And I saw how they developed their curriculum, and I figured I could develop an American curriculum versus the green laning and all that, which is nice. It's fun. It's good wheeling, you know, but the Americans tend to take it a little bit to the extreme. So I thought there's a way I could develop that. So I came up with a curriculum, and that was in 1985. 1986 was my first class.
put it out there to friends and family, and and you've been an uphill battle ever since, you know. And here we are, 30 plus years, you know, as a business doing four wheel drive training and guiding. Yeah.
You've been doing it full time.
Yes, I've been doing it full time. I took about, my wife said, get poop or get off the pot. And so I said, okay, great. And so about 5 years into it, we really started making it a real business. I went to a couple of out education courses, learned about financial statements and business statements and things like that. It helped a little. But because four-wheel drive training was such a new model, there was nobody out there doing it. So I really had to kind of cut the rug on that. I could model after the Land Rover program, but that was big corporate driven, and those folks, they're getting paid by the corporation versus me trying to make a living and pay the mortgage and put kids in college, So a little different story. But so that happened, and I was going pretty successful with the business classes out of Denver, Colorado. And then in 91, some of the folks at the Campbell Trophy said, why don't I try out again? And so I did. I tried out, and I got a seat. And so I competed in the 91 Trophy, and that was in Tanzania. And that kind of gave me a lot of street cred with the Rover crowd. The Jeep guys were kind of like, okay, we know what you're doing and your background's there, and I don't want to discern between the two, but, the Rover crowd, said, okay, now I've got some kind of formality to it, and it opened a lot of doors. Dealership, would hire me for this kind of training or that kind of training, but I'm kind of a lone wolf, and I'm not a corporatist to begin with. So, I fit in well enough to do the teaching and all that, but I didn't fit in well enough to become part of the Land Rover cadre, which all well and good because I have my own business.
So let's focus a little bit on the Campbell Trophy because you're obviously well known for that. I didn't realize you had tried once and then tried it again. Tell us a little more about the Campbell Trophy, what you did, how it went. I don't think everybody's familiar with your experience with the Campbell Trophy. I'm sure our listeners would love to hear about the Campbell Trophy.
Yeah, sure it is. It's kind of interesting. It's the World Olympics of four-wheel drive, and, it had all those monikers at the time, but it was a classic adventure race that was vehicle-based. In 85, I put an application in for the Australian event, and it was kind of not well-known, certainly in the United States. And, people are like, what the heck is that? Are they smoking cigarettes or something, or are they riding camels? Nobody really knew who was doing it. They didn't know about R.J. Reynolds and all that. So in 91, it had evolved into a well-run organization. And so the 91 event, I succeeded, got a seat. I partnered with Webb Arnold. And actually, he was from Grand Junction, and I live in Grand Junction now, so we see each other once in a while. We finished fifth out of the 18 teams that were there. The event, basically, if you're not familiar with it, is it's an adventure of 15 to 20 days and start in one place and travel across a foreign country that is generally has little roads or very, very, very rough roads for, 1,000 miles or 1,500 miles or so. And throughout that, there are about 10 to 12 special tasks. And the special tasks are how one would win the Campbell Trophy. So you collect points. If there are 18 teams, if you finish first, you get 18 points. If you finish last, you get 1 point. So that's the point basis. And so there were time speed distance rallies that were 300 to 500 kilometers at moderate speeds of anywhere between 5 and 35 miles an hour because it's off-road, off-pavement. Some of the sections we would get up to 50 or 60 miles an hour because you're on a dirt road trying to make up time. So that's time speed distance. So you had to calculate that. My navigator, my partner Webb, was great with a stopwatch and a calculator. And so think of trying to do mathematics in a closet with somebody shaking your chair. That's what navigators do. And so we did that. And then there's some where we had to, take a transmission and swim across a river with it on a pole and build a raft and then swim it back and then run a couple of kilometers on an orienteering course. It was pretty crazy, special tasks. And then maneuverability, because it was a Land Rover-based event, so we had maneuverability. So that was a pretty intense event. Ours was about 20 days, 21 days. Tanzania. Most of it was muddy and wet and rainy. So it was 105 degrees and about 180% humidity, And so we'd be driving day and night. One of the sections we had to winch, literally we had to winch about 15 kilometers because you just couldn't drive. It was just so wet and gooey. So we had approximately 22 trucks from the 18 countries and support vehicles and doing that. And so that, that gave some street cred,
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Sure.
What were you driving specifically?
That year we had it was new. It was a five-door Discovery.
The year in 1990, they did the three-door discovery, or, you know, two side doors and one back door. So the first year for the five-door discovery. And the discovery is pretty new. It was a stick shift. We had a left-hand drive vehicle. They were diesels. So they, you know, they were very robust vehicles. Literally, they handed us the keys when we were inspecting them, and they said, "This is a 30-day car. You better make it last." Yeah, which is kind of nice, you know. It's like driving a rental, you know. Yeah, yeah, you know, it's kind of fun, yeah. So, you know, we had to go through and do a P&M, you know, if you're familiar with dealership, you have to go in there and check the lug nuts and all like, the hoses on the turbochargers and things like that. And some guys didn't, so they blew a turbo. Other guys didn't know how to drive really well, so they burned out their clutches. There were two clutches that got burned out, and they had to be changed in the field with hand tools. So one of the guys we saw what was happening, they actually burnt the clutch out and caused damage to the transmission. So we had to drop the transmission transfer case center diff out of the truck. So we winched it up a tree as a lift and dug a hole underneath there and dropped the transmission, separated everything, and then a helicopter brought the new parts and took the old parts away, and we swapped it, you know, with mosquitoes and leeches crawling up your legs. Now, good stuff, you know? Yeah,
fun times.
Yeah, fun times, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I look back now, and it's all fun, you know? It's like military service, you know? Here in the Army, it was always fun back then, you know? Yeah.
Well, you romanticize everything, don't you?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, the fish gets bigger. Yeah, that's right. Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Would you do it again? Would you do it now?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm 65 now, so, you know, it's a younger man's sport, or young person's sport, I should say. There's women that did it. But, yeah, I eat, drink, and sleep it. So, yeah, I would do it again. Yeah, and I think physically I probably could do it now I'm an old guy, but I'm in good shape. But, yeah, I don't know if my wife would approve because, you know, that event was almost 30 days by the time it's all said and done, and that's a long time to be gone and pay the mortgage and all that. But you know, it was certainly well worth it. Yeah. Absolutely.
But it definitely helped your business then as a result. So now I guess we'll move a little bit away from the Campbell Trophy, may come back. So it's helped your business, and now you do this, continue to do the full time. And I believe you also work with the U.S. military, maybe even foreign militaries, and I think other manufacturers too. Is that not right?
Yes, I do, because I've been in business long enough. I've got a reputation for training trainers, although I train regular people. Most of the military training I do is we're training their specialized trainers in how to operate their vehicles. So whatever the platform is, and some people think, oh, I'm just teaching new troops how to drive a Humvee, but it's really not. We're teaching them to drive Defender 110s, Land Cruisers, whatever they can get in a foreign environment, you know, let's say Africa, for example, the Middle East, so it could be a Mitsubishi or a Nissan or who knows what, but, you know, a lot of Rovers. So because I have Rovers for training, they come to me for that. And then I do corporate safety training. So people like oil field inspectors that have to run pipelines, I'll teach those folks how to drive pickup trucks safely. And then, surveyors for mine companies and things like that. So there's a lot of industrial. Most of my business, I would say half of it is recreational, and the other half is split between military, corporate, and safety training.
So what do you do specifically for, say, the average person? I know you have classes. How often? How can people participate?
Yeah, absolutely. I enjoy the recreation side. And really, I started the business to teach people how to drive their vehicle safely and from an environmental perspective. It's, you know, to me, it's I care. And you know, sometimes people just do it as lip service, but I care. So I thought, all right, great. Let's teach people how to operate their vehicles. And then what that'll do, I was kind of selfish in this, is that then they'll get interested and want to go out for a 5 or 6 day camping trip. Nowadays they call it overlanding, but, you know, let's call it camping, car camping. And because I love that kind of stuff. And I didn't want to do it early on. I wanted to be an outdoor educator. The Boy Scouts was okay, but I thought there was a different way to make a living, like Outward Bound or Knowles or somebody like that, you know. But I just thought that with the advent of the vehicles, four-wheel drive SUVs, and I like trucks, I could probably make a living doing that. So my average class, we call it the on the road, .. It could be in Moab or Grand Junction or right here at Texas, you know, one of those things. So it's an on the road class, we call it. It's a two-day class. And that is generally about 7 to 8 vehicles max, and, you know, whatever seat belts are in there, so a family can come out and take it. And then we'll do 2 days of discussions and driving and recovery and, you know, what the mechanical sympathy is and what the things that go bump underneath the trucks. So it's a pretty intense 2 day class and a lot of seat time for the folks. So they walk away with, you know, big handout packet, a wealth of information. It's like drinking from a fire hose, honestly, you know.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, but they get it, you know, so you throw spaghetti on the wall and see what sticks, you know, and then they may come back for an advanced class, which would be more hands-on for recovery, winching, you know, high lift jack use, field fixes, you know, how to fix a flat and, you know, if there's a broken radiator hose, things like that. So I do advanced and intermediate classes as well. The guided tours, trips, whatever you want to call them, they're, you know, 5, 6, 7 days. Either a private group can come out with a bunch of buddies, and I'll take them where they ask to go, or because I'm permitted as an outfitter guide and probably half the national forest across the country. So I am a permitted, and sometimes people don't understand the permit process, but to be a permitted outfitter guide, you know, I have to meet a minimum standard of care. First aid, liability insurance, and all that, and then get the permission so that I can charge a consumer fee for public use of the land. So it's important for someone to be a permitted outfitter guide to do what I do, obviously. And I'm spoiled because I have most of the Western United States to do it in, and there's millions of miles of roads, you know. So yeah.
What do you think of overlanding? Seems to be a big term now in the United States. I've gotten the impression that some of this is coming from South Africa. There's a lot of rooftop tents and a lot of their equipment, and then they've been coming to the United States. I guess you agree with that? And what do you think about it seems to be a growing area in the U.S. where people seem to get back into camping, as you said, camping, and I guess we're now calling it overlanding. I'm just curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, it's become a buzzword. I appreciate where it came from. The folks at marketing and advertising, like anything else, they try to spin it around a little bit so it gives it a new term and a new flavor, and so it generates a new genre of four-wheeling people. You know, but the overlanding, there's some that, if you go to Wikipedia, you know, they'll tell you that this is it's more for extended overlanding trips. So in the early days, you know, when you take a Land Rover from London and drive it all the way to Hong Kong, that to me was overlanding. What we do here in the States, or, you know, in some of the trips in Europe where you're going out for a couple of nights or something like that, I mean, you could call it overlanding, but I'm an old guy, so it's like car camping, you know. I'm just using a four-wheel drive vehicle to get there, you know. You know, versus like what some people call jeeping, which is hardcore four-wheeling over big rocks and, you know, ledges and rollovers and stuff like that. But, you know, it's all well and good. It's a good mix. But I tend to, you know, I have customers who say they want to go overlanding and we'll do it, you know, but it's basically car camping for 5 or 6 days. I have a lot of customers that buy these larger vehicles or Land Rovers, and they'll travel from Prudhoe down to Tierra del Fuego, you know, and that's an overlanding trip, and it's an expedition type thing, and they have to be, you know, aware of what's going on. So I'll train a lot of folks like that, and then they go on about it and have a good time, you know, honestly. So I think it's a good thing, but I think sometimes terms pigeonhole us. So, for example, the word jeeping, you know, scares people and they think it's 40-inch tires on Jeeps, and it's not. You know, it's, you know, people out here, if you're, they're trail riding, you know, what they call it, and that could be quads or UTVs. So I think, you know, everybody can do their sport and have a good time with it, motorized recreation of some sort. I've done enough of those trips that, you know, I just still stick with, you know, calling it, we're going to go car camping. And if you want to put a rooftop tent on there or have some kind of expedition trailer, then fine, you know, drag it along and we'll make it happen. And it's all well and good. You know, to me, it's just an excuse for people to get out in the woods. And so I find that that's the benefit. Right. I don't care if you're from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon, or, you know, Key West down to San Diego. If you're taking the time to load a truck up and go out for even a night with the kids and the family or your buddies, that's what it's all about.
So what tips do you have for folks who are maybe first-time overlanders or car campers, or maybe even seasoned car campers?
There's instruction. It's although I make a living doing instruction, sometimes people don't know what they don't know. And sometimes experience gets in the way of experience. It's these little cliches that I've learned over the years. I find that a lot of folks have a good amount of seat time and they understand what the truck is all about, but they don't necessarily know how to get it unstuck safely. And so they do damage to the vehicle or they hurt themselves or their family. And so, you know, there's an issue there that I think that folks should spend, you know, if they're going to spend $1,000 for a winch and a bumper and, you know, another $1,000 for suspension, maybe spend a couple hundred dollars on some training. You know, so. Yeah, you know, it's like, you know, right. And learn how to use the tools. That's exactly right. And so I'm kind of keen on that. And I think
once that, it could be just a club thing, you know, go out for the club and go out with somebody that's experienced that can share good knowledge, and, you know, not poor skill sets, but good knowledge. And so it doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to hire me as a trainer, but you could go out with a club and get that kind of skill set development. There's a program that I started many years ago. It's called the International Four-Wheel Drive Trainers Association. And is now, I think we have 60 to 70 trainers worldwide. It's a high standard of education. It basically takes the four-wheel drive skill sets for recreational, industrial, and military, and it has formalized it into an academic process. It's a five-day peer review that they must go through to be accepted as a trainer, certified trainer. Some folks do it for their own happiness, and others do it because they have a job in South Africa and they got to go there and teach, you know, people how to drive. So, and it's easy for folks to seek those folks out. Those trainers have met a minimum standard, which is a very high standard. And so you could just go to the i4wdta.org website and look at trainers that are nearby, and you know that they've made the grade. Plus, that helps me if I have a group that needs an instructor in each vehicle, say a military or industrial training. I can call through this pool of people and say, I know that they've met this grade and that I can have them teach my students, you know, I can trust them in a truck. So yeah, I think that, and then secondarily, get a vehicle that's built appropriately. You can buy a brand new one off the showroom floor that's super capable, but it may have P-rated tires. So, you know, change the tires to a little bit more robust, better construction tires. Get some basic recovery equipment. It doesn't have to be a winch or any of that kind of stuff, but, you know, a recovery strap, a shovel, high lift jack, and then learn how to use them. You know, practice with them in the backyard, you know, and then, you know, so when it does happen, when you get a tire stuck in a hole or something, you're not going to have to worry about calling a wrecker or walking out for 10 miles. You can be proactive and get yourself unstuck. I think those are the key things. Just be, carry the skill set and the care to be able to have that responsibility for yourself and your family. And then thirdly, maybe, get yourself prepared by having advanced first aid knowledge for wilderness. Just being able to know CPR and first aid from the Red Cross is okay, but you're going to be out in the woods for 2 or 3 days, and it may be 2 or 3 days before you get any cell service or any kind of help. And I think extended patient care is important.
Or as Terry Ann Wakeman mentioned in her book several times, bears. She always wonders why I worry about bears. I don't. I just find it funny that, you know, talk about bears and then you put the food up high. And yeah. I just find it. Bears are actually, even in my part of Pennsylvania, yeah, there's bears are coming back and they're, you know, moving closer and even into urban areas, and so they're feisty. Yeah. And apparently it depends on which one too. There's black bears, brown bears, and grizzlies, I think, and there's a difference between how you act with each one, and so it's, you know, it's just, I just find it funny, bears, you know, but yeah, it's all good. Why don't we get back to Land Rovers themselves specifically. So you've owned a 66 2A, you've owned a 67 2A, and I know now you have, I believe you said you have 3 current Land Rovers, if I'm not mistaken. 4, okay, well, you'll talk about that in a moment. But just maybe, you know, run through what you have now. What's your favorite? I did kind of enjoy that when I met you. You was like, why did you bring the Defender? It's the one that started. So, you know, that, which is sounds like typical Land Rover owner. But I'm just kind of curious what you own now, or what have you owned in the past? Is there one you miss?
Yeah, for sure. I miss them all. you know, I miss the series, the 88 inch, you know, because it was just, you know, basically carry a spanner in your pocket and a couple of Whitworth wrenches and you're good to go. You know, duct tape and binding wire. But, you know, really the vehicles were designed for Ahmed in the middle of Namibia to fix it, you know. And so they've modernized them. Let's, you know, oh, well. But, yeah, the 67 2A, the 88, was we had, you know, good memories with the kids and going canoeing and traveling across country and all that. But the Defender 90, I used a Jeep in the early years of my business. Because that was what is available at the time. And then as soon as I heard that the Defenders were going to come into the United States, I saved up my pennies. And then in November of 94, I bought this one, the Defender 90 that I have now. Over 200,000 plus miles on it, and they're working miles. We joke about it's only been driven to school. So, yeah.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, so it's got a fine patina, and, you know, some guy was talking the other day and says, yeah, it's really legit. And I'm like, I guess it is. You know, it's just a good work truck for me, you know, and it runs. Honestly, it does. A lot of my trucks are student-driven, so, you know, it's me in the passenger seat hoping that we don't die, but, you know, generally they drive, and, you know, things happen. And so they're a robust vehicle. That's why I chose Land Rover. The Jeep I had, it's no
no bad mouthing the Jeep guys, but you know, it wore out, and it was a light duty vehicle, so I needed something that was heavy duty. And I just remember my Land Rover days and said, I'm going to buy a Land Rover and be done with it, and here we are. I bought that 90, and then a few years later, I bought an 87 Range Rover. That was the first year that it came in the country. And I got it into Colorado, and it had a 3.5 liter engine, and altitude was, you know, kind of sorry. And so I found, at the time, I saved a pennies again for a couple of years, and I found a wrecked long wheelbase that had a 4.2 in it. So I shoehorned that into the 87, and that engine's been in there now for 20 plus years. That engine, that actual engine, has about 300,000 miles on it. The truck has about 350 to 400,000 miles. Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yep. And it's transmission's all original. The engine was original at the time, diffs and all that. So, I mean, they're very robust. The 95 Range Rover Classic, I got that. I was looking around because I wanted the modern amenities of the interior, because that was the first year they put the disco interior inside with the climate control and all that. And it was an air suspension short wheelbase. Got it from a guy who took really good care of it. It was pristine. It took me about 4 or 5 years to look for this particular vehicle, and it showed up, right? So I got a pretty good deal on it, I think. And it was pristine, and he was concerned about selling it to me because he actually realized what I do for a living. And he was like, well, I just fixed the air dam, and, the sunroof really works. I'm like, don't worry about all that stuff because it's got to be changed. So I got that, and lo and behold, he had a shop who I knew. He had an oil cooler line burst, which is a common Rover thing. So get a new oil cooler line, folks. And it burnt the engine up. And he had a shop that I knew who actually said, I need you to have them go inspect it so I know I can buy this truck. And he said, oh, they're the ones that put the engine in there. And I said, oh, you didn't tell me about the engine. He said, yes, I blah, blah, blah. I said, okay, great. And so they had put a 4.6 in it. And so it runs really well, and it's a pristine vehicle. Of course, I've had it in service now for 3-4 years and starting to get its patina. Student-driven, and so I like that. Now, I go between the 90 and that truck, the 95, because I have no problem driving either truck. The 87 I can drive all over the place, but it's rough around the edges. The 95 Classic is last year I drove from Colorado to North Carolina because of the weather. And, it was just a simple trip, drive out there, 75, 80, 85 miles an hour. And then I did the job I had to do, hard wheeling, and turned around and went back home. It was just great. I didn't get beat up. The 90 beats me a little bit. I have to wear hearing protection and listen to the song in my head, and all that, it's Land Rover stuff,
Stuff.
Yeah. Right. It's like riding an old Harley, you just hum to yourself and keep thinking that it's cool,
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. Right. Hopefully somebody weighs that.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's nice. Yeah. And they're in their comfort control Cadillac, Yeah.
Hey. Uh-huh. And they're looking at you and pointing.
That's right. Yeah.
I understand.
But
that.
Yeah. And then we bought a Disco 2. Some friends of ours had a Disco 2, and I thought I needed to upgrade the fleet, so to speak, with electronic traction. And I didn't want to go newer because of maintenance. So those are the four trucks I have. I'll throw it out there, but I do have a couple of Toyotas because they're right-hand drive stick shift Toyotas, so that I use those for training. But those are they're all covered. But the Rovers are my go-to trucks for sure.
And I believe you're also a motorcycle guy, Harley, because the first time I met you was at Mar, maybe 09, I think it was. It was the first Mar that was not at Pearl's Pond, and I think I remember you had driven across country in your motorcycle. So tell us maybe some about your motorcycle.
Yeah, I'm a Harley guy. As a kid, I had a Honda because that's what I could afford, at the time. Nothing wrong with it. A Honda's a good bike, But I grew up, driving one of those. Now they call them dual sports, but back then it was, it was a crossover motorcycle. Upswept pipes that you could take off road and drive on the highway. Get out of the Army, and I bought a 51 Panhead. Jumped right into it. Right. Did the work on it, and much like a Land Rover, you're a good mechanic if you can work on the Harley and a Rover. So I had that. We had that for years, long time, and then finally get tired of kickstarting, and as my wife says, she just get tired of pushing the Harley more than riding it. So we upgraded to an 03 Heritage Softail Harley. So a classic. It was 100th anniversary edition. Beautiful bike, electric start, no problems. And it's just comfortable, big seat, and it runs. That's what I want now. I'm 65. I don't want to kickstart a truck, a motorcycle. Although, you never know, right? I might go back to the Panhead again.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. Sure, sure.
But yeah, I haven't done like the BMWs or any of those motocross bikes or any of that kind of stuff, or cross, you know, the dual sports or anything like that. Because I make a living outdoors. I don't need to extend my free time that way. I spend easily 130 nights a year in a tent outdoors. And so I do it with the motorcycles. The Harley is more like a fun thing for me to get off and go fast on the highway. You know, people chuckle, Harley fast. Yeah. Well, you know, it's, you own a Land Rover. Yeah. Harley's fast. Yeah, right.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So if someone's wanting to get into overlanding or even doing more off-roading themselves, I assume you're going to recommend a Land Rover, but what kind of things, and maybe you don't, maybe you won't, but if you do, you know, what do you recommend they look at or look for? Is there something to avoid? And, you know, answer however you like, kind of looking for maybe tips for folks that maybe it's their first time doing that and they're like thinking about getting into the off-roading, and, you know, should, and maybe what should they focus on too? Should they start with, you know, good tires, or do they put air lockers in immediately? You know, those kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. What happens is folks tend to want to go crazy all of a sudden and you know, put a 6-inch lift and 40-inch tires. The magazines do a good job of showing that to us. What happens is that those vehicles are hard to drive on the highway. And they put people in a pickle because their skill sets aren't adjusted for the vehicle. So I like folks that want to start out by a whatever new vehicle they have or use one and then kind of learn to drive it, you know, have fun, you know, take some hits with it and then start to modify it, you know, get the good recovery equipment, get some skill sets. And then, you know, if they want to do the winch and the bumper and, you know, suspension and lockers and all that. But a lot of the modern vehicles have electronic traction, and it almost negates lockers to a certain extent for the average, you know, recreational four-wheeler. If they want to get into hardcore, then they're probably not going to buy a new vehicle that has electronic traction control. So generally, in the Land Rover world, I tell folks to look for an old Range Rover, because that's got a tailgate. I like the tailgate. Nothing wrong with the disco, folks, you know, but I like the tailgate.
Yeah, right.
And it's old school enough that it's usually going to be in pretty good shape, but yet it's easy to modify. And then they can drive it, and they can, you know, put a center differential lock in there, you know, and then eventually if they want to add suspension, tires, and all that, it's an easy truck to build up. Generally reliable. You have to be handy if you're going to get into this sport. If not, then buy a new vehicle and keep it under warranty, and then just do the slight dealership modifications that they allow. And they do, they'll put, you know, different bumpers and skid plates and things like that, whatever, you know, if it's a Ford, Chevy, Dodge, Jeep, or Land Rover, it doesn't matter. The dealerships want to make the money on it, so they'll do aftermarket approved installed items. So that's a good way to go, and you can wrap it up in the payment, you know. So, but generally speaking, some folks for a buy-in, you can't beat the Rubicon, JK Rubicon. I mean, it's solid axle. It's got lockers. You know, it's a friendly vehicle to aftermarket and all that. To my Jeep friends, you know, it's still a Jeep. You know, it's not a Rover, right? And so, you know, the Rovers, I think, are just much more robust. So I think, you know, either a Disco One or a Range Rover Classic would be a good starter vehicle. You know, the new Range Rover Sports and the, you know, the LR3s, LR4s and all that, they're highly sophisticated vehicles, quite capable. But those are, they're using electronics to manipulate the brakes so that the differentials perform like they're supposed to. And it's relying on electronics, and that can be a problem in the long run. Especially if we start getting into more enjoyment of, you know, might hit a tree once in a while or something by accident. So I tend to coach people into getting, you know, something that's a little bit older, and that's easy to work on and generally more affordable in the long run.
Your training class, that was fantastic, by the way. If anybody ever gets the opportunity to see you, truck to teach is really good, because you took a differential, you know, opened it up, showed us what was going on, showed us even, you know, a broken half shaft. And it was well done, sir. Good, being a visual learner myself, that was very helpful to have the visual learning of what was going on, and brings to mind, then, you know, you're talking about the modern vehicles being a lot more electronics going on, which is good and bad. You know, kind of a personal statement for me that I worry about, and I suspect you probably will too, is so we get more into electronics and we even get more into the self-driving cars, it's who's going to be driving? Where's the challenge going to be to test yourself as you're going off-road and worry about the line? And I think
I think even you joked at in the training class about soon kids will be looking at their cell phones and while the car's driving itself going over an obstacle. And you're like, yeah, I can see it happening. Generally, what do you think of the current crop and maybe where Land Rover's even going? I worry they're getting out of the business. And of course, you know, the new Defender's supposed to come out, and what's gonna happen? I don't know if you have any thoughts on maybe the future direction of Land Rover, or maybe even the future direction of where four wheeling's gonna go.
Yeah, indeed. You know, it's kind of like a Pandora's box when we start talking about that. I'm a loyalist. I have nothing to do with the corporation, but I'm a Land Rover geek. I think here's the thing, from my perspective, is I get enough vehicles out in the backcountry that when they fail or break, the electronics become a major problem. And there's no fallback on those vehicles. If they would do some kind of manual override to make it a regular four-wheel drive vehicle or something, you know, lock the transfer case or lock the center differential or something, allow that to happen, maybe even as an emergency hatch kind of thing, you know, that way they'll be able to get off the trail and get fixed. Otherwise, the electronics fail. It's, you know, third gear high range, and this air suspension goes down. And there you're going to damage the heck out of a truck trying to get it off a trail. So that's the issue. Now, it doesn't happen that often, but it happens often enough that it's a concern when I have those vehicles on my trips. You look at other manufacturers. I'll throw Toyota out there, and again, it's not a competition or anything like that. But you know, the Toyotas have a manual transfer case locking center differential, so they use electronics to enhance that. But you can still put it in four wheel drive and then go old school and drive the thing out. I wish that Land Rover would do that. I think with the Defender, they're going to, I haven't seen it. I don't know anything about it, and it's always been speculation anyway. You know, so I hope they keep it old school, or at least the systems are there because they're building into the Range Rover Sports and you know, the LR3s and 4s and the new Discovery and all that. So it's there, and the harness is already there. So they're going to use electronics. I know that. You know, fuel economy and safety and all that, it makes sense to me, absolutely. But there should be some kind of manual device or override to help with that. And that's one reason why I coach people to go with something that's a little bit older that has those manual devices that we can lock the center differential and do two-foot driving to get the truck out of a hole.
All right. I have to do a personal thing because you, back at Mar 09, you helped prank my buddy Scooter. And I just want to thank you again for that. That's all. And a little shout out to Scooter, too, because hopefully he'll be listening and say, you know, I'll tell Scooter, hey, listen, I got to talk to Bill Burke, and he remembers pranking you. So this is cool. You know, yeah, it was wonderful. I have a comp. I did a video record of that, so I'm going to get your address, and I'll send you a copy of the video so you can watch that. But yeah. All right, Bill, we're coming to the end of our time. I have to ask you, do you got any other Camel Trophy stories? That'll be an honor, Scooter, because Scooter's a big – he introduced me to you and Camel Trophy. So in honor to my good friend Scooter, do you got any Camel Trophy stories you can tell?
There's a lot of stories. I'm an old guy, so there's all sorts of fish that got away. But there was one, my partner and I, we were in a time speed distance rally section. So we were doing, you know, on a dirt track going through the middle of Africa at night, you know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, two track. And there was we could see the lights of a truck in front of us, and they were on a similar course as us. If you're familiar with time speed distance rally, you have to follow a tulip chart, and they tell you where to make the turns and at what distance and what speed you have to run. And so we were running a little bit fast because we were slow behind on the clock. And my partner Webb was like, I got to run fast. So we were running fast, and I caught up to the truck in front of us, and it was the Japanese guys. And they were on the track, and they wouldn't let us pass. So I kind of ran up on them, and I tapped with the bumper. And we joke about this because they have the Team Spirit Award and the Camel Trophy, and the Americans were kind of going for the Mean Spirit Award, I guess, you know. So we tapped them, and, you know, you could see their eyes, you know, they're like, oh, you know, and they kind of sped up a little bit, you know, but they were still in my way because we had to make up the time. So I tapped them again, and then they kind of moved over a little bit. And so I went off to the left side to clear around them because they had a right-hand drive vehicle. They were Japanese. So they went to the right-hand side, and I went to the left-hand side. And as I was going around them, there was a huge cactus that I clocked. And it was like, it looked like a sahuaro, but it was, you know, it was an African cactus of some sort. I don't know, because we were at about 30 miles an hour. And it hit the windshield, and if you're familiar with the line, the brush risers, the limb risers that come off all the Camel Trophy trucks, those wires, it gets stuck in between that, and it wouldn't get off the windshield.
And so we had the wipers going, and it was bleeding that milk, that cactus milk, all over the windshield. And I'm yelling at Webb, get out there and move it. And he's, I'm not moving it. I can't touch it. I'm not going to touch that thing. I have gloves. I don't care. You know, and it finally looked like a dead guy on the windshield going back and forth, smearing this milk all over the windshield. We couldn't see, so we had to stop, get the damn thing off. And the Japanese passed us again. And like, ah, you know. So we finally, you know, caught up to him again, you know, but they realized I was behind him this time. But it's like, you know, I'll never forget the dead guy cactus, you know.
Well, Bill, thanks for coming on the show and talking to me. I really appreciate it. It's been actually a personal honor to have you on the show, because you were one of the first, when I conceived having the podcast, it's been 4 years now. You were one of the first people on the list of people I wanted to get on the show. Folks, you can find Bill Burke at bb4wa.com, which is BillBurkeFourWheeling.com, and also International Four Wheeler Drivers Association. Well, what's the web address on that one, Bill? I didn't write that down.
I4WDTA.org.
So if you're interested in becoming a certified off-road driver, it's the Four Wheel International Drivers Association. I know there's one lady here that's going through that program. It's Sarah, right? She's supposed to go through that program herself. So thanks again, Bill. Appreciate you coming on the show.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. It's been fun.
And that is the June 2017 show of the Center Steer Podcast, show number 51. I can't believe we're at show number 51. We've been doing this 51 times, 51 months. We've been doing this month in, month out. I cannot have done this without the contributors, especially Morgan and Harold. I thank you very kindly for joining us month in, month out on the show when you can. You know, we do this because we like it.
When we can.
We do this because we like to talk about Land Rovers and we enjoy it. We get no remuneration. I certainly don't pay you guys. maybe we'll get
certainly
there someday.
Don't pay us enough.
And, you know, we have some money coming in from Patreon that pays for the website, getting stickers, and maybe some other things down the road. Hey, thanks, guys. I really appreciate it coming on the show, helping out. There's things you do behind the scenes that folks don't know about to keep the show going, and I really appreciate it. Also, thanks to One True Pax for his production support, making the show sound much, much better, I think, than it has been. If there's a little delay in getting the show out, it's because I send the track over to Pax, and he edits it when he has the opportunity and the time, because he's busy too, and sends it back to me.
And not getting paid.
And I, you know, good point, Harold. I'm glad you brought that up. He reached out to me to make the show sound better. So that says a lot, and I really appreciate that, Pax. Thanks for doing that.
It says a lot, depending on how you look at it, a lot of, you know, from two different sides. Either he really wants to be generous and help us make the best product, or he really thought our product before was so bad that he had to do something.
I'm going with the former.
One or the other.
Yeah, let's go with the former.
And also, big thanks to Bill Burke for joining us on the show. I was very excited and honored to talk to Bill Burke. He didn't really know who I was before, walked into his trailer. He was really nice, generous of his time. And I will also tell you that following the conclusion of that interview, Bill did break out some whiskey, and I had shared a couple whiskeys with Bill. So that was that's a good memory I'll have.
Yeah, that's really cool. And I do appreciate him doing our little show, given his lofty status and his busy schedule, and he made time to be there for us, even though he really doesn't know who we are.
Yeah, it's really great to have him on the show. It's a great interview, and I mean, to hear his story, it's really a true American story. So very thankful to have him on the show. And it's nice to have Harold back, too.
Well,
it is.
Okay.
It is. And hopefully we'll get Dave Carroll back soon. Dave has undergone bone marrow transplant. And that's actually, I think, complete now. So hopefully Dave will continue to improve, and we can get him back on the show and get him back behind the wheel, too, for that matter.
Dave's a badass. He's going to fight this thing with everything he has and kick its ass, I think.
He's certainly doing it so far.
It's awesome. He's awesome.
Well, I hope you enjoyed the show. Thank you for listening to the show. And remember to visit our website for past shows and show notes. You can connect with us on Facebook, Twitter, and now Instagram. There'll be links out on our webpage to all of those services. And you can also directly support us through our Patreon account, which is patreon.com/centersteer. And there's also a link to that on our webpage. We'd love to hear from you and what you're up to in your Land Rover. Next month, we're working on several different guest options for next month, including Martin Port, who was at the Classic Works opening. Until then, I ask you to share the show with one other Land Rover fan. Thank you for listening. Wave as we pass by. We'll
he kaplinked his mic and then walked out of the room.